shared this quote that you, well, you actually just shared a visual for this quote today by a guy called Rohan on Twitter. Even if you have a job, you're an entrepreneur. The only difference is you only have one customer. I thought that was really brilliant because, I mean, first of all, why don't you just elaborate on like why you like that one so much?
Yeah, I mean, Rohan, if anyone's not following him, we should put his Twitter in here. The guy's a genius. He's built like 3 or 4 seven-figure companies in his house in the last couple of years. And he's like, the way that guy can like spot opportunity and move on it is unlike anybody I've ever seen. But he's just the insight that this sense of security, especially with, you know, what's happened in the last few years, or the last year, I should say, the illusion of security and the illusion that a job is going to be the thing that's going to look after you forever is, you know, everybody can take their own risks as they're comfortable, but there is huge opportunity in, you know, not necessarily quitting your job and like throwing everything out, but building skills that allow you to start creating that hedge. So, you know, if you're a designer, a writer, if you're an engineer, there are skills that the market values beyond just the single customer that you're working for. So I think, as brutal as it is to hear, it's a pretty astute observation. And we're all like agents of our own outcomes.
Welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi. This was a special live recording with Jack Butcher, the founder of Visualize Value. This was his second appearance on the podcast after our epic conversation in October last year. Jack has become one of the leading creative minds on the internet. If you're not following him already, I highly recommend it. Just follow his Twitter and Instagram accounts at Visualize Value. He's grown those to over 400,000 followers in just 2 years. His business brought in over $1 million last year. For more of the backstory, you can check out our first episode together from a few months ago. This was the first time I've tried a live conversation like this. We had people join from all around the world, from the US to Europe, Mexico, New Zealand, and even someone who stayed up in the motherland, 4 a.m. in Pakistan. To join me on the next live recording, sign up for updates at creatorlab.fm/live. We split this episode up into 2 parts. Part 1 is the interview, and part 2 was a Q&A. You're about to listen to part 1, where you'll learn all about the evolution of the creator economy, going from Kevin Kelly's 1,000 true fans to Lee Jin's 100 true fans to what Jack Butcher talks about as the importance of one true fan. We talk about the content product machine and the factory as a product. We go through unique examples of monetization, from audience first funds to knowledge influencer startups to productizing your knowledge, and the importance of packaging, owning phrases, and outcome-based marketing. And Jack breaks down his 2020 revenue transparently on the screen. And after you finish this episode, make sure you check out part 2, which should already be in your podcast feed. That was the live Q&A. We make reference to many visual concepts and designs that Jack has illustrated, so if you want to see some of those, you can see the full video on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. Let us know what you think of this on Twitter. I'm at BZady and he's at Jack Butcher. Now let's get straight into the show. Thanks everyone for joining today. This is a special edition of Creator Lab. We've got Visualize Value, Jack Butcher in the house, and this is the first time I've ever done this, so bear with us as we work through all the sirens in the background and everything like that. But really cool to have so many people join in today. So look, Jack, we already did this epic conversation a few months ago, right? And we had, I think it was almost 2 hours of conversation about your story, how you grew Visualize Value, all of the tactics, and a lot of philosophical stuff too, which I think really resonated. So we're not going to repeat all of that today. I definitely would recommend people check that out after this if you're interested. But let's just kick off by giving a little bit of a summary of what we both see the creator economy to be. So I got an official definition from Signalfire. So they said it's also called the passion economy, which is a class of businesses centered around independent content creators, curators, community builders, including social media influencers, bloggers, videographers, plus software and tools that are designed to help them with growth and monetization. But I think when we spoke about this, it sounds like you've got a little bit of a different view on this. So like, what does that mean to you when we say the phrase creator economy? What do you think about?
I think we talked about this over text a few weeks ago. The idea of the modern starving artist being, you know, a potential definition of a participant in the creator economy, because I think the connotation or the passion economy, I think maybe is even worse than the creator economy, because it doesn't even imply creating anything, right? It's just like, hey, if you love something, you can make a ton of money doing it. And clearly that's not the case in a lot of industries. One of my favorite examples is, like, if you love playing basketball, like, there's plenty of people that love playing basketball, right? And if you're not in the top 0.01%, you are not going to be getting paid to play basketball. And I think in the creator economy, you know, I think the metaphor or the comparison is not as extreme necessarily, but you definitely run the risk of, you know, just because you're participating in this economy does not necessarily mean that you're going to be the beneficiary of economic gain. And I think a couple of things that I've learned over the years by accident have, like, you know, I'm sort of, I guess I'm a participant in this, but I would never have, like, I would never have selected myself into the creator economy. It's just like, I've ended up there as a function of doing a lot of different things, or at least how some people would classify it based on the definition you just gave.
That makes a lot of sense. And I get what you're saying, because even just the word influencer, I think that's got a lot of connotations nowadays. You might think of people, you know, peddling like smoothies, shakes and stuff like that on Instagram, which, you know, I'm not against anyone doing that. Good for them. But very different approach to what you've done. I think if we're looking at kind of like the history of what it means to create content online and build an audience, and actually even before creating content online, if you just think about writing or sharing books and documentaries before that, an example me and you spoke about was Tim Ferriss, right? And a lot of people watching this will know who Tim Ferriss is. And he might be one of the first people that we read a book and said, okay, I want to go and do what he's doing, or at least take some of those concepts and start something. But we talked about how that was one of the worst ways to actually monetize an audience, if you think about it today, right? He sold a $10 book, you know, and he's done completely fine since then. But, you know, if you look at how big his audience is, it isn't necessarily the best way to actually make money from it. And then later he started a podcast and now really successful, still makes money mostly from ads on that side. So we're going to explore that idea today of how people can have a much smaller audience that has a lot of resonance, but they can actually, you know, make a living and do things that they actually really care about. So that's going to be the frame of the conversation today. Was there anything else I missed out before we go forward?
No, I think that's spot on. I think the economic forces have changed since Tim Ferriss's day, right? And he's like, the guy's a visionary. He was on it way before everybody else, so made a great living doing it that way. And obviously incredibly talented. You can't, like, remove that from the equation. But the fact that this now has a name and there's everybody wants to participate in it means by definition it's way harder to just run with the playbook of the first person to have ever cracked it, right?
Completely, man. And just one other concept I wanted to bring up here in terms of that timeline we were talking about. A lot of people listening would have heard of this phrase, 1,000 true fans, right? That was coined by Kevin Kelly, who was the Wired dude. And essentially the summary from my understanding was, you can make a living with 1,000 true fans. The definition being those people are going to buy everything that you put out. If you think of a musician, they're going to come to all of your concerts. You know, they're going to buy CDs back in the day, whatever. But in recent times, there was another kind of revision of this, which was 100 true fans by Lee Jin. And she talked about how, given those differences in, you know, tools that are available and the way that we interact with people, the economics have actually changed. So, and my kind of takeaway from that was, it went from a world of, you know, paying for stuff because you were trying to help out that starving artist, and moving to a world where, you know, you're paying for something tangible and valuable. And I think that you definitely embody that with what you've done. So let's go into some of the, you know, what happened last year for you, because it was kind of a crazy year for you guys. You started at the beginning of the year with less than $100 in your business bank account and ended up with a million or so. So is that something you'd be able to share a little bit more context around?
Yeah, I can. Let me just pull up a screen here. So this is not fully. This is not the whole story because it's just one of the platforms that we collect sales from. We also use Gumroad. So about here, we're about like 850, and you could see January was what, $5,000 here, and you know, throughout the months, we, you know, some good months towards the end of the year, and then something we want to talk about in December at the end of this conversation. But yeah, I think discovering this leverage was something that happened throughout the year last year. And honestly, years before that, finding things that worked that led to the, you know, led to the findings and the iterations on the business model from, you know, selling time, being an agency, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I love that. I remember when we did the first interview a few months ago, we talked about you hitting 100K a month, and someone commented on YouTube saying, this is a lie. Like, how's he making this much money from, like, what's he doing? Selling a community? It's only $100. And yeah, that really stood out to me because you're literally showing people, and if you're listening to this on the podcast eventually, you can go on YouTube and watch this because Jack just shared his screen. And that's been a big part of how you've grown, right? You've been working in public and showing people this is actually what I'm doing and providing value for people. So let's go into a little bit about, you know, we talked about the 100 true fans, but you've talked about using a service hedge, right? And when we discussed this earlier, we said that there are, you know, a lot of things people think in black and white terms, right? We're either someone who's a slave in a cubicle working a job, or with someone living the dream, doing nothing on a beach all day. And of course, I'm kind of simplifying here, but that's kind of like these two ends of the spectrum. But you've talked a bit about service hedge. Like, where does that play into all of this?
Yeah, I think I'm like, this is just a preface and put a caveat on everything I'm going to say in this entire conversation is going to be dependent on the experience I had, right? So I came up through the agency environment, you know, brute force grunt work for 8-9 years of like, nobody wants to do that, you do this, especially when you're at the, you know, at the bottom of the pile in those environments. And one of the things that struck me as like difficult to understand about the 1,000 true fans thing is, how long is it going to take me to get 1,000 true fans, right? It's going to take forever. Like, even if you're like the musician example, how many gigs you have to play to get 1,000 true fans? It's like, it's astronomical, right? So the way, like in hindsight, I look back on this now is you really need one true fan, and that fan can be a client, especially if you've, you know, developed a skill set that can generate a result. So if you can have this single interaction, this single relationship with one client where you really start to understand what it is you bring to the equation, what advantage you give to someone by, you know, by them hiring you, being in a you know, being a recipient of your service, and then scaling from there. It wasn't until like I went from, you know, everything to everyone creative shop, where all my clients were kind of happy, but they're happy just because I'm doing what they asked me to do. They're not happy because like I could not have got this done anywhere else. Like, there's a unique thing happening here that I'm like, that I'm grateful for, that I think that becomes the insight that you can start to build towards the 100,000, et cetera, et cetera. So you can really like dial in on your strengths in a very, very, you know, high feedback environment where you're just doing one thing for one person or one business. And this, like, the least sexy answer, and it's the last thing that people want to hear, but it's the safest hedge, right? It's like you're building a skill set, you're delivering a result, you have a body of work that comes out of that relationship, that then once you have that, you just go and find the second person with the same problem, and your advantage compounds from there. And as you get better and better at that, when you get to 1,000 true fans, it's a different game. 100 fans is a different game, because you can't have 100 fans, or you can't have 100 clients as a one person freelancer, unless your job is to, I don't know, make people cups of tea or something. If you're doing anything involved, it's going to take you a long time, right?
Yeah. I mean, this brings up the concept of the permissionless apprenticeship, I think you call it, right? And you've actually got a whole curriculum that you developed around that. So Could you share a little bit more about the origins of that? Because I think for more context, a lot of people talk about this, you know, concept of audience first businesses or building an audience, and you don't actually think about it in those terms, it sounds like. It's more about first having something to share in the first place, and a lot of that is building skills that are of value. So the permissionless apprenticeship kind of ties into that.
Yeah, so this is, again, a realization in hindsight. And at the start of my career, the internet didn't look like it does now. It's definitely there, but it's not what it is now. And I think the seed for this idea came from having a design background where we would do unpaid work to get work. Like, that's just how the design industry operates. And a lot of people have a huge problem with that, right? It's like, what do you mean? We have to work for like 3 weeks on a presentation, and then we go to a pitch and we're among 6 participants, and then, you know, 5 of them don't get the job. In some cases, 6 of them don't get the job, and you've like burned all this money and effort making this thing. But where I think there's an advantage for you operating as an individual, in that instance, as an agency, you can't share the work you did because you're under NDA. You've done this thing. It's like, just put it in the bin. Like, it's useless after that point, versus like you undertake a project without permission in public. So you say, hey, you know, I love this company, or I love this brand, or I love what this person represents and what they talk about. I have a skill set that aligns with, you know, a result that I can generate for them. I'm just going to do this thing. Then I'm going to ask them for permission to publish it, use it, et cetera, et cetera. So it's obviously a lot more involved than that. And there's like, you know, things to think through, and like, how to identify opportunity there. But at a fundamental level, it's the difference between, and I was stuck here for ages. It's like, you spend months trying to figure out how to market yourself to solve a problem versus just spending months solving the problem and then show people that you've done it, right? And I think we have like an aversion to solving the problem before we get paid because we think we're being hard done by for some reason. But it's, again, a hedge, right? Not even the cash compensation. The portfolio is a hedge. The ability to solve a problem is a hedge. The ability to show your work is a hedge. So that, to me, is, that's where that one true fan situation stems from. If you want to like find the vehicle for building the relationship with the first true fan, that's the vehicle, is just do something without permission, show it to them, and, you know, it's not going to work every time, but you're going to hit eventually.
It's a really interesting concept, and I've seen even people from your community have reached out to me and said, hey Bilal, I love this podcast and I've created a clip for you, or I created some animation, which is amazing. I'm trying to take the other side here, because I definitely agree with you, but a lot of creative people I speak to, especially creative people, say I should never do creative work for free. And I'm trying not to use any politically loaded words here to trigger anyone. Sure. But a lot of people say it comes from, you know, there's a privilege in being able to even do that, right? In that, okay, if you've got kids at home to feed, you and you're working 3 jobs, you might not have time to do this potentially. But I'm curious, like, your take on that other side of the argument.
Yeah, I think if that's how you feel, I think that you are entitled to that view as well. I think what we think should be true and what is true are 2 different things as well. Yeah, you have to like, there is somebody that's gonna do it if you don't. That's just what, that's just how it works, right? Unfortunately, like, we would all prefer it to be, well, I don't want to speak for everyone, but maybe you would prefer that not to be the case, but it is the case, right? It's like, I think in the design community, you don't get a job unless you have a portfolio that demonstrates your ability, right? So you don't go to the interview and wing it and say, hey, I'm good at design. You have to show a book of work and say, this is what I've done. This is what I'm capable of. I'm sure the same for a lot of technical careers and, you know, in certain professions, you need certification, you need qualification, you need all of this stuff before someone's going to give you a scalpel to stab into someone or, you know, cut someone's skull open. You can't just dive in there and do it. And this method is not true in every single case either, but operating on the internet and being a part of the creator economy, it is a vehicle that can get you that first opportunity. And I think another way to think about it is that idea of a hedge, or the idea that you are increasing your market value by doing this thing, means you're not working for free technically, right? I know it's like it's a different way to think about it, but it is increasing your market value. It's increasing the opportunity that you'll be exposed to. It's a foot in the door for the job that you want. Like, this isn't exclusive to entrepreneurs either. This is like, hey, if you want a job and you show up to an interview with like a little prototype built, versus somebody who just comes in and says, I got a good work ethic, who do you think is going to get the job?
100%. Yeah. When we talked about this last time, I think it was on Twitter, and maybe I'd responded to one of your tweets about this, and someone responded to me saying something along the lines of ROI is like a financial term or something like that. I can try to pull it up. So
I remember
in the
that.
Final version. And my reply was, first of all, I'm not trying to argue with anyone on the internet, because that's a long thing to do. But I said that what is the ROI of bringing up your kids, right? Like, if you're bringing up your kids, you're not looking for financial return. Maybe one day when you want them to look after you or something like that, but you're trying to bring them up and spend time with them to say, this kid has become an adult, a great human being. They help other people with good values. And that's obviously an extreme example. And I'd say the same, the way you just said it, is I've done this before, where I've worked pretty much for free. It wasn't necessarily like actually free. I think I got like a lunch stipend or something like that for my Pret a Manger sandwich. But it was essentially me just showing up and saying, okay, this is what I can do. And then you go and leverage that brand. And I also said that pay isn't always financial. Sometimes it is the experience, it's the connections, it's the environment that you're in. I think we can put a pin on that, but I really definitely agree. And I think we're on the same side there. So let's move on to your approach to monetization. So we're going to, again, this is going to be the bulk of the conversation. Again, for people who haven't heard or tuned in late to this live conversation, the first conversation, we went through a lot of your full story. So to try to recap, you had a job, you became a freelancer, you turned that freelancing into an agency. You worked on building your value over time and your skills. And then crucially at that moment, you found what problems there were in the world that were related to your creative work. And then you ended up looking at distribution or audience building. So we're going to go into some of these, but you brought up this topic of content market fit, and that audience doesn't always equal distribution. Could you elaborate on what that means?
Yeah. So I think the process of building audience is, you know, not all audiences are created equal in a sense. So the idea that just because you have the ability to reach X number of people means that you can convert that to a monetization opportunity of a certain scale is false, right? It's more about the overlap between the types of people you can reach and the types of things you can do or build or like show people. That's where the monetization happens. So the more overlap there is there, the better. I think we talked about the example of the Instagram influencer has 1 million followers, couldn't sell 20 t-shirts or something of that nature. In the same way that if I go on Twitter tomorrow and say, hey, I'm starting a makeup line, who wants to buy, you know, the Butcher cosmetics? I don't think anybody's buying that, right? So it's the intention you have as you build that like increases the overlap between, you know, the people who like what you have to say and want to buy what you're selling. And in a lot of cases, those two things overlap. So the difference between like building audience for audience's sake and like, I think building like a network and a community and an opportunity to, you know, create economic leverage is this outcome-based approach to product and marketing and content. And like, again, in hindsight, looking at content that kind of embodies what you can do for people or what your product can do for people or the way you think about a problem. It's like if you sell information or you sell your experience, your content on the front end is just the constant ability, the constant demonstration of your ability to think through those problems and apply solutions to those problems. So that to me is where over time, like this thing becomes a flywheel. So if you're operating at the scale of 1-to-1, this is, hey, person X has a problem. We can sit down, you can solve that problem. And then you sort of unpack how you solve that problem and how you thought about solving that problem. That turns into content on the front end that helps other people identify with the problem you solved. And then over time, you know, in the case of visualized value, the front end asset just got big enough that it brought in more client engagements than you have physical time to fulfill on. And then it's like, okay, now that the market is kind of, or the, you know, our infrastructure that makes contact with the market has hit a ceiling, like there's an income ceiling here. This is how many hours you can spend in a day or how many freelancers you can hire that are of the, like they have the experience you need to, okay, there's clearly like a bigger idea here that if you could put it into a product that generates that same outcome, then the ceiling gets broken and you can, you know, you can break the time barrier, as it were.
I can see Adil in the chat here sharing an example of the SeatGeek guy. Recently shared an influencer with 15 million people was bringing in single digit sales. I don't know if that means like single digit, literally like single dollars or pounds, but if that's the case, that's kind of crazy. But again, yeah, there are other people, and we're going to go into some examples. Wow. 8 to 9 sales. Wow, that's crazy. So yeah, we're going to go through a few examples later of people that are doing it well. But it just shows that, you know, that person could potentially sell something else and it might work really well. But I think a lot of the time people take this cookie cutter approach where they see someone else working for someone else and they just try to do exactly the same thing, like a t-shirt with their brand on it or something like that. Mm-hmm. Just one thing I want to go into a little bit deeper there. You talked about working on something so much that you become known for something, is kind of how I took that. How do you stop yourself from becoming pigeonholed into, you know, that's the visual guy, right? Like, so for me, as an example, when I first started the podcast in 2015, I was recording, launched in 2016. I was interviewing all sorts of people, right? They were all mostly business people, but I didn't really have a focus around kind of what I've been doing in the last 6 months. And I've seen the growth in the last 6 months to say, okay, this is worth me doing in the short run at least. But ultimately, mm-hmm, I have so many interests, right? And I don't want to just feel like I'm like someone who's only going to talk about one or two topics. So I'm curious, do you have any advice for someone like myself? And I'm sure many people listening who have so many different interests. How do you kind of prioritize, but also not get pigeonholed?
I think there's two sides to the argument. One is the, if you ever read any Seth Godin, his like, be a professional. Have you like stumbled across any of his writing on that? Whereas like, to some degree, this is like going back to the basketball analogy. It's like the pigeonholing might be a function of you finding a problem that people want solved. Mm. And like, that's not a bad place to be stuck sometimes, right? Mm. It's like, if you found like product market fit, content market fit, whatever else, it's like, it may not be completely in line with your wildest desires of how you want to spend your time, but it is like a pretty excellent place to arrive at commercially, right? So I think there's a couple ways to, like, you can either build systems around that and like get yourself out of it, or you can identify what it is about that thing that's working that can potentially like offer you other creative opportunities. So Sean Puri came onto our office hours a couple of weeks ago, and he had this great analogy of an audience being a stem cell. So I think what he's articulating with that is, if you have you know, been authentic in that journey, in sharing what you're up to and like, you know, connecting with people in a, like in a genuine way throughout, they're kind of bought into the way you think and the things that you're interested in. And that gives you this bit of optionality, right? Where, I think the problem like starting with the problem piece is important, but the next stage of that is kind of the personality layered on top of the problem, right? Because there's a ton of people solving the problem. You could do that at a small scale. You could probably make, you know, high six figures, low seven figures with like some form of agency business that is like nearly splitting at the seams doing that kind of stuff. But then like your personality then becomes a differentiator. It's like you want this person's perspective on top of that. So I feel like there's like opportunities to diversify your projects at that point when you have distribution. So you're pigeonholed in a good way. It's like I can, hey, I'm the Creator Lab is going to start doing workshops in New York, and you go and try that for 2 months. You're like, ah, wasn't really for me. Creator Lab is going to go and do like, he's going to start a product design studio. Ah, wasn't really for me. So I think like that, the consistency to the thing, like to sticking to the things you're interested in, like gives you more optionality than we're actually aware of most of the time. I think it's a self-imposed limitation in a lot of ways. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, that makes sense. And I think what I'm hearing from your side, and correct me if I've misunderstood this, is especially in the early stages, maybe there is a need for that kind of focus, but there's still always room for experimentation if it's like authentic to what you care about. And yeah, that's kind of how I kind of heard that. But was that right?
I think so. I think again, there's like there's so much conflicting advice about it, and this is why we're having this conversation around like passion and creator economy. It's like I think it's Scott Galloway says, don't follow your passion, follow your talent. I think he said that, which is I think solid advice. And the other thing is, I don't think problem solving gets enough credit in this whole situation. It's like the dopamine you can inject into yourself by really solving people's problems is a powerful feedback loop. So the idea that visualized value as a service could be applied to like a company that makes, you know, mixes paint, and then a company that sends rockets to Mars, like those, the process of solving the problem is that solving the problem visually is a thing that I'm interested in. So it doesn't necessarily confine you. If you're approaching it from the talent side, that is the interest, then you have more wiggle room on the application as well. So that's a, like, there's another great analogy about like peeling potatoes or something around this idea, where you like, you get given a tool and like a bag of potatoes. By the time you get to the end, you're like, I figured out how to peel potatoes now. I don't want to do that anymore, right? So it's like finding situations that allow you to like use your skill set to solve new problems. If you want to stay at that like creator level scale and not turn into this like big systemized, productized agency, I think that service hedge can be applied in and keep you interested. And we talked about this. You're still doing some service work, and it's interesting, man. It just like keeps exposing you to new problems. It like feeds new insights into the products you want to build. It's I don't think it's a bad feedback loop at all. Yeah. I think the social network movie and all of that, like, hey, we have to build a product with 1 billion users, is leading people in the wrong direction in some cases.
That's a great point. And I think it comes back to that nuanced view, right? Like there's what I said at the beginning of the conversation was, there's people who think you either a slave to the system or you're, you know, balling out like Mark Zuckerberg. And I think what people miss is, first of all, that's a process, but also like just speaking personally, like I work, you know, maybe a few days a week on, you know, working with other companies, and I'm like more than happy to do that because one, it keeps my skills, you know, relevant. I'm seeing live what's happening in, you know, high growth startups. I'm still building connections and learning stuff. So I think sometimes people just have a very black and white view of something like that and glamorize one side or the other. And it's not like that. So one thing you mentioned earlier about, we talked about building in public and the upsides and the good parts of that, but there is also some bad downsides that people don't really speak about that much. So have you experienced much of that yourself?
I mean, I could give you a couple examples. One is definitely like characters coming out of the woodwork that you haven't spoken to in a long time that are now your best mate, as you know, you've heard all of that, those stories before. Another is like people ripping off, like literally ripping off your product. So like, you know, stealing, downloading it, uploading it somewhere else and trying to sell it at a discount. So you have to like pay people to go and take down like piracy, like pirated versions of your products. There's a certain amount of pressure you put on yourself when you build in public as well. It's like, you know, the one of the like best feedback loops and one of the most motivating things, I think, is promising people things that you haven't built yet. And that's like a ton of pressure on yourself to be like, this thing's going to come out in a month. I know it's going to be good, or I have a good, you know, good instinct that it's going to be good, but you never know until you hit send. So there's definitely like, you're halfway through building something in public and then you never know on launch day whether or not that thing is going to be, you know, it's going to be received well or it's going to flop. It's definitely going to give you material to talk about either way though. So that's, I think, if you can look at it as agnostically as that, then you get something to talk about regardless of what happens.
One other nuance I do want to add to that is often people talk about building in public. That doesn't necessarily mean showing absolutely everything. Right, it means showing what makes sense. Like there are plenty of people who don't share the ins and outs of their algorithm or things that are working for them as well, but they use it to their advantage. So let's move on to kind of some of the infrastructure that you've been building and how you think about this. There was a tweet recently from someone who talked about Tesla and that factories build cars, Tesla builds factories. And Elon Musk responded to that saying the factory is the product. And this really resonated with you and it was something I loved as well. But you were talking about something really different by taking that kind of concept and applying it to people.
Yeah, I think it's obviously a grandiose example, the wealthiest guy on the planet. But the mental model, I think, is just a like phenomenal frame at any scale. Right? It's like this idea that the result of your process, in this case, is a car, but your process is the thing that creates the value, right? You're, in their case, it's like literal conveyor belts and things bolted together and sequences and things of that nature. In, on an individual level, it's your experience, your the way you think, the way you attack a problem creatively. And I was thinking about this a little bit. To speak to my experience specifically, like the visualized value, the first product, how to visualize value is a car, and then build once, sell twice is a factory. Like what methodology did you use to pull this experience out of your head and turn it into a product? So thinking as the designer of the factory, when it comes to like building up this intellectual infrastructure to make things, like the factory is kind of an analogy for your ability to deliver a result. So all of this experience you're codifying, the way you would walk a client through a process is the same way that, you know, maybe you would then add leverage to that process by turning it into a curriculum. So it's like there are stages to this thing where it becomes almost mechanical and it feels like ridiculous to make that comparison, but I think it's interesting because that's how you differentiate between just waking up every day and like selling your time to, you know, codifying some belief you have into a system that produces a thing.
I love that analogy because it's actually so visual that like I'm thinking of like a big factory with cars going in it with a big face at the top, you know, like it's quite hard think of that. But so I understand that like the cars in this case in the factory are essentially like the pieces of work that you're creating to show off the ability of what you can create, right?
Yeah. And then if you wanted to, so I think there's a few layers to it. So at the client level, it's like the process you use or that we use in the case of visualized value to extract how a business works from somebody's brain, right? We interview people, we understand like, what is it about this thing that, you know, that makes you able to deliver a result differently? We then assemble all of that stuff in a more coherent way, and it comes out the other end of the factory as this packaged thing. In the same way that if you think about the raw ingredients of somebody coming through an education product. So if you think of an education product as a factory, somebody on one side is coming in as like, I don't know how to do this thing. And on the other side, they should come out, go back to the outcome-based thing. I know how to do it, right? So you have this process that is changing, like, you know, taking raw ingredients and building something different on the other end. I think, you know, in the car metaphor, it's a raw lump of aluminium that comes out as this like functioning vehicle. So I think, again, as grandiose of an example it is, it has to follow a process in order to generate a consistent result. And I think if you're building anything that you want to work at scale and to break that barrier, I think, you know, thinking that way is an essential part of that process.
And to build on that idea, you shared this quote that you actually just shared a visual for this quote today by a guy called Rohan on Twitter. Even if you have a job, you're an entrepreneur. The only difference is you only have one customer. I thought that was really brilliant because, I mean, first of all, why don't you just elaborate on like why you like that one so much?
Yeah, I mean, Rohan, if anyone's not following him, we should put his Twitter in here. The guy's a genius. He's built like 3 or 4 seven-figure companies in his house in the last couple of years. And he's like, the way that guy can like spot opportunity and move on it is unlike anybody I've ever seen. But he's just the insight that this sense of security, especially with, you know, what's happened in the last few years, or the last year, I should say, the illusion of security and the illusion that a job is going to be the thing that's going to look after you forever is, you know, everybody can take their own risks as they're comfortable. But there is huge opportunity in, you know, not necessarily quitting your job and like throwing everything out, but building skills that allow you to start creating that hedge. So, you know, if you're a designer, a writer, if you're an engineer, there are skills that the market values beyond just the single customer that you're working for. So I think as brutal as it is to hear, it's a pretty astute observation. And we're all like agents of our own outcomes, right? And I think the mindset shift that you have when you're suddenly responsible for, you know, you're responsible for everything. You've made this shift from, you know, working a job to operating a business. You see the world in a very different way. And I think some of that mentality you could start to leverage earlier if you like start to leverage these principles while you're still employed even.
And I actually think it's really interesting in the age we're in right now. So for context, we're recording this at the beginning of 2021 after a crazy year we've all gone through where there's been, you know, a huge shift towards people being able to work more flexibly because we were all forced to. But it actually brought up this feeling for a lot of people, which was, okay, the whole economy is going to shut down for so many different parts of the economy. And if you actually just had one job, you were actually at more risk in many ways than someone who mm-hmm. traditionally was taking a greater risk by, say, being a freelancer. But if you were a freelancer with 2-3 clients paying you even the same amount as a job, you were in a better place than someone who was unfortunately being fired for that. And of course, there's pros and cons, and you can also lose your clients. But I think when you have a job, you're pretty much saying, I'm working for one person. Maybe you can have a side gig or something like that. But I think it's a great thing to bring up. I also love the way you've been talking about packaging, and I think it's something you do incredibly well. Again, kind of sticking to the factory analogy or the same world anyway. So for example, you know, your course is called Build Once, Sell Twice, right? And you've got some incredible names essentially for what you do, but you've thought a lot about this and how important packaging is and how you go about doing that. So could you elaborate a little bit more on how you think about it?
I think that, again, this is like some advertising conditioning that comes from like writing lines for, campaign. So it's like, has to work on a bus, has to work like in a TV ad, has to work over the radio, has to work in the signature of an email. And you have to convey so much in this really short, this really short combination of words. And I think, like, the more I think about it, it's, you're in the same distribution metaphor there. It's like, if the words you use to describe your product don't imply that outcome in some way, then you're at a disadvantage from the start. So I think there's two ways to think about this. Like, you know, wasting a ton of time thinking about names is not an intelligent thing to do. Some people will tell you that. And then the other way is like, hey, if your product is positioned incredibly well, you're essentially either running a surplus or a deficit, right? So you have a name that is better than your product, or you have a name that is worse than your product. So maybe the name implies a benefit that your product doesn't provide. And in that case, you get lots of unhappy customers. Or if you're, you know, running a surplus, all of the language you use on the front end just, it continues to increase your opportunity. So if like Build Once, Sell Twice, for example, was named like how to make like how to turn your experience into digital products and sell them on the internet, it's like, I'm not really that bothered. It's not that differentiated. How do you start to like build a content strategy around this very like memorable idea? I think we'll see a lot more of this. Just people owning phrases, ideas. David Perel's one of my favorite examples in this space, like personal monopoly, niche fame, paradox of abundance. People like Nassim Taleb write books, Anti-Fragile, Skin in the Game, Fooled by Randomness. It's like, it's intriguing enough that you're like, what is this? I want to learn more about that thing. It just implies this hook. So I think about it like a valve, right? It's like if you have a great name and great communication, you're going to get more traffic through that valve than if you have a name that doesn't speak to the benefit, the outcome, the quality of the product you're building. So it's a huge advantage if you can nail that.
I love that phrase, like the outcome-based learning. So even, or just outcome-based in this case, because even like when we were talking about my podcast last time, you said to me, I said, hey, Jack, like, great conversation. Have you got any advice for how I should package this and share this out? And one of the things you said to me was, yeah, if you can speak from the end, right? So like reverse engineer it. So if someone's listening, tell them what they're going to know or learn by the end. And I'd already kind of done that with this phrase of like, you'll learn, but it really did change that kind of switch in my head to say, like, put myself in that person's, you know, seat. And if they're listening to this, what are they going to feel like at the end of this? What are they going to know that they didn't before listening? So are there anything else to add on that? Like how you've thought about for visualized value?
I think like I wouldn't even say that I have it 100% figured out. I think it's been, some of it's a happy accident and some of it is like just thinking about it for just an absolutely unnatural amount of time. This is a thought I had this morning. It's like this outcome-based stuff. So you're not competing with like the tweet above you or below you or anything. You're competing with like TikTok. You're basically competing for someone's time with the most outrageously addictive stuff on the planet, right? So that's why I think the lean towards outcome is like, tell me why I should care, tell me why I should care. Like that is really the mechanic that should be going through your head. And I can instantly tell whether I've done that well or not 5 seconds after you send something out. Like, especially on Twitter, it's like, oh, I didn't really imply like what's in this for you or why you should care about this. And it just like, you instantly see the feedback that it's like flopping. So it's just so obvious that that's the way you should think about writing and communicating, but we overlook it all the time, man. Like if you ask yourself, like, why would I care? Why would I care? Why would I care? Every time you look at a piece of copy or a piece of a design or anything, it's a powerful device to just get you to an outcome.
Let's talk a little bit about examples. So we talked a bit earlier about Tim Ferriss on this timeline, millions of people selling a $10 book. You know, again, if you want to talk about growing audience, listen to a few of the previous episodes with Jack, Sam, Power Pomp. We talked all about this. But really on the monetization side, things have really started to change. So are there any examples of people who are doing this in an interesting way for you?
Yeah, I think there's a ton. Like Twitter is where, you know, where we met, where I hang out most of the time. So all of my examples are going to go that way. But yeah, David Perel, Tiago Forte, Pomp, the Pomp family, man. Those guys are just so prolific.
Pomp, Felina, and the brother. What's his name? Joe? Is
it? Joe.
Who's just like incredible. Killing it as well with his sports just business content. Incredible.
Yeah, and I think those are just phenomenal examples of a craft paired with an interest that is just created this stem cell that can become whatever you want it to become.
You talked about Sean earlier, who hosts My First Million with Sam Parr as well. I think Sean's really interesting because you mentioned the stem cell, but he's been doing some really interesting stuff because he's actually been, you know, he's created a fund now. So not only is he using his audience to, you know, he's got a newsletter that he was charging for, but, you know, this guy's like a legit business person. He sold a company. He works in Twitch. He's not just someone who is just like, hey, I'm going to sell you a random course or something. He's got really amazing skills to share. And then he started a fund where he basically tweeted it out and said, hey, who wants to, you know, I'm meeting all these startup founders all the time. I'm going to invest in them. You can join my rolling fund. Pomp did the same and a few others as well. So, and actually just one more I'll mention is Ben from MakerPad. Well, the whole MakerPad team, they're doing incredible stuff. Also represented the British crew out here. they've been doing some really interesting stuff in the no-code space. And they just started by creating amazing content for no-code, teaching people how to use the tools. And now they've got, you know, a thriving business. And also they've launched a similar fund where they're now going to go and be the specialist investors in that space. So I think that's another interesting way of looking at it. I also thought this idea of the knowledge influencer or being a founding knowledge influencer was interesting. Maybe you don't like the word influencer, but you were actually involved with this recently with a guy called Gagan Biyani, who just started a new education company. He's also the co-founder of a company called Udemy. Next week, Wednesday on Creator Lab, that'll be an episode as well with him talking all about that space. But you were an angel investor, I believe. And when they published their kind of memo online and talked about all the people that invest in the company, they actually grouped a whole bunch of you as knowledge influencers. So could you share a little bit, whatever you're able to share on, like, you know, even if it's not that specific example, how you have thought about leveraging your brand to be able to get access to stuff like that?
This is another like crazy economic change that's kind of just crept up in such a short period of time. Like, just to go back to the example you used for Sean's fund, like how you could raise millions of dollars in like 48 hours or something. I think he like filled his fund in 2 days, which is like, if you have the right partners aligned and incentivized, you can do just remarkable things. I think let's come back to Sean's stem cell analogy again. It's like, if we're a startup with the objective of reaching like these voracious learners in the technology space, then why not partner with people that have already built this huge amount of trust and reputation in that space and incentivize them to grow our product as well? So you kind of like can move your own little private market in a sense. I think as a whole, we massively undervalue like what Twitter is capable of. And we were talking last night about even Clubhouse and things like the barriers that are just like being smashed through on the gatekeeping front. Like last night we saw Pomp, Meek Mill, just a huge cast of like massive stars, and Pomp is up there like lecturing people on Bitcoin and the crypto space.
Crazy.
And it's like, 5 years ago, you'd think that's nuts. Like I don't think access, like I don't think you could leverage your reputation into like opportunities so quickly and so like fluidly. It's like this really, you know, such a liquid asset. And obviously you have to use very good judgment, because what's the Buffett quote? Spend 20 years to build a reputation and you can destroy it in 5 minutes. This is very fragile. But if you, like we said before, if you're thinking about it properly, then you're not going to end up as the person with a million followers that can only sell 8 t-shirts. You're only going to get involved with things that are like mutually beneficial, long-term, you know, reciprocally beneficial situations. It's fascinating, man. And I think I first read this on the Naval tweet storm. It's like, eventually you'll get to a point where you have too many opportunities to choose from to know what to do with. So your judgment then becomes more important than your like output necessarily. So it's like the balance eventually tips the other way, I feel like.
Another way of thinking about it is, a year ago when you were kind of really ramping up, or maybe 2 years ago, whenever the timeline is, if you said, hey, I was approached to invest in this company by a guy who created a $1 billion education company, he basically got the pick of his investors. He had people like Naval in there. He had all the top VCs, a bunch of those other knowledge influencers we talked about. They could pretty much get who they wanted because they are A-list founders. Just to be in that, of course, we all see the value in what you would bring to the table. But that's only because you've been doing this every single day for, you know, 25, 50 reps a day of writing a tweet and creating something. And I've just been, you know, really impressed, just even as someone who's become friends with you, like even your text, man, your text feel like your tweets in a personal way, obviously, and there's humor and stuff. But it's just, I remember when I texted you for the first time, I was like, this guy is just dropping bars every time we talk, you know. So it's kind of a funny way of thinking about it. But I was saying the other day that you've just been doing this so many times that that's just how your brain works by this point. And maybe you always like that, I don't know. But
definitely
I don't
not.
Know actually yeah, is
not.
Is that just come from the reps, essentially?
Reps,
right?
I think. Yeah, I think the agency environment, like, as much as I love to like hate on it in retrospect, it's just like, you just have to, you have a deadline, you have to come up with 50 ideas by next week. You just get through stuff, man. You just write stuff, and like, you have to rapidly bone up on like industry X and understand everything about this thing, and then like regurgitate it in a simpler way. So I think it's just like a ton of repetition, and then it's just pathways or, you know, some constructs that you've seen work. A lot of it just becomes intuition. It's like honing your gut at a certain point. Yeah. It's like, I think if you're going to write, I don't know how many tweets I've ever written, but it's got to be up in the thousands, right? Which I think, even at a subconscious level, it's just changing the way you think about language or the way you string your words together. And yeah, just an inordinate, like unnatural, you know, to some people, just like idiotic amount of reps.
Yeah, completely. I think the way Pomp described it to me was, even from like the growth side, and you're talking almost from the creative side and honing your craft and skill, but even from like the algorithm side, like the way Pomp described it is overwhelmed the algorithm. And that doesn't mean put out a bunch of crap all the time, but if anyone follows Pomp, you should follow him on Twitter. You know, he's got 450,000 people or something like that following him, and every day he tweets out the same thing in the morning, like good morning, accept, and then he'll say something funny about like accept a random group of people, and that he's done that hundreds of times by this point, you know. So it's really, really interesting. So just to stay, did you have a thought there to add?
I just got one idea that has like popped up, and watching people like Pomp do this is like, because attention is shifting to these different mediums, it doesn't mean that like the way we've consumed media or the way like the patterns in media that we've like grown to appreciate haven't disappeared. So like I got a car for the first time in 10 years. I don't know if I've told you this yet, but a couple months ago, every time I get in the car, the radio comes on, right? And it's one of like three songs playing every single time you're in the car. It's like, what is going on here? But you're always
Cardi
like,
B, you know, Drake, tapping. And who's the third one?
Yeah, Ed Sheeran or something. Oh, yeah. Okay. He's like, man, this is nuts. The same song every single time. And it's like, yeah, people are loyal to their radio stations because that's what they want to hear. It's like every day I want to hear these types of tunes. Like there's like A side and B side tracks, and everybody that's got like 20 A sides has probably got 500 B sides. So I think that's another analogy for like the pomp methodology overwhelm the algorithm. And then if you find a format that people are eating up, don't abandon it, man. Just like absolutely go all in on it.
Not to turn this into the pomp love fest, but last night you texted me saying pomp is everywhere, right? Because we were both listening to him talk. And the next day you go on Twitter, you see him in the morning, and then you turn your TV, he's on CNBC talking about it. Then you open the inbox and he's got an email to you. But that what people don't realize, and you guys can listen to this on the podcast, I did an hour with him. He talks all about how he built that, and it really was one platform at a time. Originally, because a lot of people see the end result and they say, oh, well, you just go everywhere. But really what he was doing was being very concentrated, building up those reps, learning what works, and then taking it to the next one and the next one. So, look, just to stay on topic here, so we're going to answer some questions in a little while too. You mentioned a few good examples there. So to summarize what we said, we talked about funds, starting companies as a founding knowledge influencer as a unique way to monetize your audience. We talked a little bit about creating physical products and digital products a little bit. Maybe we can come to that in a second. One thing I do want to call out is you mentioned services there as well. And this is quite an interesting one because a lot of people don't realize let's just use the idea of a podcast. A lot of people say a podcast is successful if it's in the top 50 and you've got a million people listening, et cetera, et cetera. What people don't realize is, I'll just be transparent about myself. I used this podcast originally, one, to meet interesting people and just, you know, sharing cool stories. But it was also my way of being able to get in the door where I wouldn't be able to otherwise, right? And someone asked me today for an introduction to someone, and I had to say, look, man, it's quite hard for me to just intro you just to pick their brain. Like, no one likes that. So this is a little bit different where the dynamic is so much. I can ask you about your childhood. I can ask you about your dog. I can ask you about the ins and outs of your business, and it's not weird.
Yeah.
So that's a great way to get in the door. But on the back end, there are services, right? And I won't go into all the details, but I've had people on the show who become clients because we speak for an hour or two. That wasn't necessarily my pitch up front, but they understand me, my background. They hear how I think about business. After the conversation, we talk a little while. If we get on, we might become friends. So those are the relationships that I think people don't always talk about. And I think it's worth saying that, again, to be transparent, that ended up being a contract worth tens of thousands, in other case, hundreds of thousands for me, where I'm not talking about that on the podcast as, hey, I sold some ads, right? Like, and there's nothing wrong with selling ads. I've done that for some time as well, until recently. But just to put in perspective, I can charge $18 to $25 on average on CPM level for podcast ads, right? So for 1,000 people, I'm going to make $25. That's not even worth me really worrying too much about, right? Like one of those people listening could end up being a client and make me $10,000 or $100,000. So I just think people can think creatively about other things that might be in it for them. Is there anything else to add from your side? Because I know you started off with the services too for visualized value.
A similar experience to you, like through growing this thing, I've gotten to talk to people that are like, I would have perceived to have been 10 times further ahead of me or have everything figured out and be like, you know, I'm done. Like, I'm just doing this because it's fun. I've got what I need. I think as a function of the market and the passion economy and all of this stuff, it's like, oh, that person seems to be having fun doing what they're doing. I'll just do what I love doing and I'll make $1 million too, or whatever, you know, the milestone is. And I think that it's going to take a certain amount of time for people to be comfortable enough with you as a practitioner to even like buy a product off you, if that makes sense. So it's like the amount of trust you need to build up to get into the product world is there's just a function of how long it takes humans to trust each other to make that viable, I think, versus a service where you can say, let's sit down for 45 minutes. I'll basically, it's like an interview style thing where you're like, I've done this, 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 and this. Here's the case studies. Like, I will work with you personally for this long and we'll get this result figured out. Again, not glamorous, not sexy, but it's just like if you have a podcast with 1,000 listeners and you have a very, very specific problem that you solve and a specific skill set packaged in a, you know, outcome-based way, I think you're going to be way better off monetizing through that vehicle in the short term. And then over the long term, the stem cell, to use, to keep going back to that analogy, gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And eventually you can deploy it to do different things. And I think, you know, even if you're working a job, Sean's a good example of someone who built the audience while he was still working. You know, I think there's great, that's a great example for people too. It's like going all in on a podcast as a monetization strategy is quite frankly completely nuts.
Yeah, it's definitely 100%, especially just in the traditional ads sense.
Yes.
You know, and again, I would differentiate by saying there's some podcasts which are entertainment. And if you're a comedian, you're, you know, musician, whatever, you're talking about all sorts of popular culture or whatever. Oh, I sounded really old there. Sorry, popular culture. That's right. I meant to say like stuff going on in the news or whatever.
Things people care about.
Things people care about. Yeah, so that's a very different vibe, right? But talking like we are, talking about the ins and outs of what's going on in your world and your business, like this is a very different sort of podcast to even how I built this, which is, you know, a great podcast, don't get me wrong, but they're essentially following a story arc. There's a little bit hero's journey in there. They'll tell you about the lows and the highs. And then my grandma would enjoy that conversation. But what we're talking about is really in the weeds, right? We're talking about examples of people doing things that you're not really going to hear that like just down the pub. You know what I mean? So it's but the hope is that it feels like you're just here with us listening as people are today. So one other example I do want to talk about, which isn't necessarily about making money, but is impact related. So you did this recently in December, and you basically donated. You basically said people can donate the same amount as a course or something like that to a charity, and they'll basically get the course for free. So could you share a little bit about that? Because it was really cool.
Yeah, we did, I think it was the 28th or so of December. So we were having conversations with people about, you know, at the end of the year, your account and stuff. It's like, give us, like, send all your like, the money you gave to charity this year. And as we're doing that, it's like, oh, there's an opportunity here for us to, like, maybe, you know, make a bigger impact. And thought, hey, why not try and, there's an economic benefit, there's a time period there where before the end of the year you get a tax write-off, and you know, we can like create a catalyst for people to do something good. It's been a tough year for a lot of people. Also, something interesting about it is like, let people have agency over what they donate to too, I think really made it successful. So us saying, hey, we've decided we're going to donate X to cause X would have been great, but I think this had an extra like virality component to it because people got to make their own decisions. So we end up donating like about $115,000 to, you know, every cause under the sun you can think of, really. So a bunch of food banks, a lot of, you know, people who have been affected by very specific conditions in their family have donated to research and facilities that are working specifically on those types of things. And it was just an incredible, like, way to see what people care about and, like, do something good. If you have a product that has zero cost of replication, it's kind of a really powerful opportunity to, you know, you're not like eating into your margins necessarily by giving people this opportunity. So it was just great, man. I love doing it. And
yeah, it's incredible.
I writing an article on what everybody gave money to as well.
Yeah, one thing I'd say that even from my podcast, episode 2 of the podcast was a guy called Scott Harrison, founder of Charity Water. And that was not only one of the most impactful conversations on me personally, I ended up leaving my job and joining them full time for 2 years after that conversation. But one of the things he said to me really stuck with me, which was, it's really, I can't remember the exact phrase, but it was along the lines of, you're really missing out if you're not giving along the way. And of course, look, it's a tough year for everyone. A lot of people struggling. Yeah. So like, if you're not in a position to give, then great. But not, you know, it's understandable if you can't give money at the moment, but for a lot of people, we are able to, and even if it's a small amount, seeing that along the way is so, I can't believe I didn't do as much as I do now, based on just the way I used to think before was, oh, one day I'll be really rich and I'll be able to give it away one day. And that's cool if people want to do that. But just seeing the sorts of people he convinced, people like Johnny Ive, Chris Tucker, founder of Spotify, Gary Vee, all these, Tony Hawk, these guys were convinced by him, like, hey, you can make an impact along the way. And every year they love hearing about the impact that they had with their money. And if it's not your money, it's maybe your time. So we talked about the permissionless apprentice earlier. If you're someone out there who really cares about cause and you've got a skill in design or marketing or whatever it might be, you know, that's another area where you could potentially apply that concept.
A huge area, because majority of those institutions cannot pay top dollar for talent either.
Completely. I do want to just touch on kind of looking at the future and things that you would do differently, and things that you're focusing on to grow your, you know, your scale, your business and your audience. So one of the things you mentioned to me was around strategic partnerships and distribution. So could you go into a little bit like how you think about that and what you kind of missed out on if you had done this earlier?
Yeah, so I think what I've realized, and I think what I resisted as a result of like not wanting to scale a different type of business, is like avoiding other people too much in certain situations, right? Like an agency business, the more people you hire, the more inefficient it gets, the more people you have to manage. It's just like an inverse correlation with like profit and peace of mind and all of those different things. But when you get to a place where you have something that is like is suitable for scale in some way, shape or form, there are really like intelligent things that you can do that are like, again, mutually beneficial. To go back to what we were talking about with the learning platform, you can find people that you can collaborate with that can do you both massive favors. So one example of this guy I got introduced to maybe 2 weeks ago, Sahil Bloom, writes these amazing threads on like demystifying financial concepts and telling stories about these huge, like, you know, just incredible happenings and goings on in the world of finance over the years. And we collaborated on like putting a thread together. He's got 90,000 followers in the financial Twitter space. I'm like almost the same size as his account in like entrepreneurial marketing, this and that. So there's so much crossover in the types of people that want to consume that content. And there's a collaboration that can happen there. And I think the podcast world kind of alludes to that, but it's so much more of a time commitment, right? So asking for an hour of somebody's time, where I think in the early on in the podcast ecosystem, that was really the growth engine for podcasts. It's like, you go on my podcast, I'll go on your podcast and vice versa. I don't know if that tactic is as effective now, but because it's like so much time. But I think now there's just so many opportunities for take the visualized value concept and the way in which a lot of people have opted in to learn. So we're fortunate that people enjoy the way we put the product together and the way we think about conveying information. So what opportunities does that present to us to collaborate with people that have great knowledge? So I don't know, if somebody is really proficient in mergers and acquisitions, let's say, or like, you know, finding how to identify a company to buy and how to buy it. Could we build a visualized value course with that person that we split distribution on, and we also split the proceeds? So I think that in the coming year is something that we're going to experiment with too.
In a way, this is what we're doing right now. We have different audience sizes and different types of audiences. But I mean, to be honest, I don't think either of us thought of it like this. Like, we were just like, we like talking to each other. We're talking all the time anyway. Yeah. We already did one that was great. And now let's just do another one. But in essence, that is kind of what we're doing here. We're being able to collaborate and bring worlds together. So one other example, actually, we did talk about this earlier, and I'll just say, in my last job at Chaitua, we did strategic partnerships. So that was kind of like a little bit of my world. And one of the things I saw was we did partnerships with everyone from Saint Laurent, like high-end luxury fashion, to WeWork, to Amazon, to Google, to J. Crew. And There isn't, and there's a siren going off, but we'll just roll with it. So
nostalgic.
So one of the things I realized is that it's quite hard to keep your brand, you know, especially as someone who cares so much about brand, whether that's visualized value or charity water. We cared so much about it that we were very picky with who we worked with. So how do you manage to think about controlling, you know, the way that you still have that conversation in your own voice?
In the same way that writing is like this thing that hones your gut, I think that's another example of like, you could just tell when somebody, like a lot of it is like a personal vibe too, because these people that you're going to be entering into like an economic contract with, it's like, if you don't get on with them very well, my advice is just do not even broach the subject of like writing up a contract. What is it? There's always a Naval quote for it. But if you wouldn't work with someone for a day, if you wouldn't work with someone for your whole life, don't work with them for a day,
which is
a powerful idea. And I think that's true in this case too. It's like, it's the same way you would pick your friends. I think just people that are, you know, that have interests genuinely aligned, that think the way you do, that love your work and vice versa. That to me feels like the way to identify it. And people can tell when you're doing something for the money versus when you're doing something because you're genuinely interested in it and it works. And I think that that is something that you have to, like, it's an introspective thing, right? It's like, why am I doing this? Why am I partnering with this person? Am I proud of this? Would I like go and tell like the people that I respect the most that I've done this? That's the gauge that I think a lot of people can use to figure out whether or not something is the right thing to do, or you're just doing it because you think you can make a quick buck. And if that is why you're doing it, you're probably not going to make any money anyway.
Like shared values, and it's something when it's just one individual with another, you can kind of figure that out quite quickly because you just spend a little time and speak to them. You look out for language, what they're motivated by. And I think another analogy for that is like a marriage. You know, you're going to have a baby with that person, essentially a virtual baby, and you want to make sure the values you instill in the baby are shared at least, or at least something you can work around. Love that one. So just the last couple ones, are there any other channels? I know you've started messing around a bit with text, aka SMS, for some of our friends listening. How's that been for you, and like, what are you finding from that so far?
The SMS is fun. It's like I originally started as like a daily thing, but it became I'm never going to commit to doing anything daily ever again. It's just a crazy, it's just not a good idea. But we're going to do it weekly now. And it's a great format for like having very intimate conversations with people. So the idea that I think text open rate is like 99% or 98% or something, which is just insane. But you have to like really respect that relationship too, right? It's not like an email where you show up and people like go through it in that context of like, I'm getting through my list of emails. So the context is so different when you're like firing a message into somebody's inbox and like potentially lighting up their phone screen. So use it sparingly, and it's like pure value. And like, we've honestly used it just to send wallpaper art. So that's like, you know, basically sending a free product on a really, really tiny scale on a daily basis. And people have responded really well to that. On the other medium side, YouTube is like, it's kind of the bane of my existence. Like, we get really amazing feedback on YouTube. It's like, please do more videos about this. Or there's a lot of, I say a lot, there's enough demand to warrant like spending more time there. But it's, I'm just personally like not that driven to create there. And it's like time spent versus outcome is so much lower. It's like learning your long-term gratification, like tuning your muscle a little bit. If you have the ability to like do something on one platform that you can guess with 80% certainty is going to drive an outcome, versus like on YouTube, it's like, I'm going to have to spend 10 times as long, and I don't know if this is even going to have the result that I think.
We were talking about YouTube earlier, and I put podcasting in a similar bucket, though it's slightly different, because video just adds a lot of complexity, adds lighting and you know, syncing audio and video is like, it's not as easy, I'd say. I think audio is actually, if you're just starting out picking one, there's pros and cons of each. But in terms of lift, it's the reason I started podcast first and added YouTube later. But if you're going to create 5 to 10 minute videos, then YouTube is probably the way to go. But you know, I'd say that you talked about like the heavy lift, right? And that's something I used to always hear a lot from brands who we were working with on YouTube. And they just said, well, look, I can post a picture on Instagram, I can post a tweet here, and it's just so much easier. But I will say that I think on YouTube, there's a level of discoverability and depth that you don't get on just text, you know, text or images, you know. So 100%. The sight, sound, emotion, you can storytell, and there's discoverability too. So, and it's one of the reasons when I started the podcast, we were talking about this earlier, I did the podcast first, and then only recently I've been consistently like tweeting and putting stuff out on that side, the micro content side. And maybe I did that the wrong way around, but from day one, I had to focus and say like, what do I care about? And where's the best place for me to closely have something that's close to an owned audience. I found podcasting was close to that. And for me, it was about like, if people are willing to listen to me for an hour, there's a certain level of depth that you get with that person and relationship that you might not get just from a tweet. So definitely not right or wrong either way, but worth exploring. Last thing for you, man, Visualize Value Radio. When are we seeing it?
we're gonna get the transmitter put up the weekend, start broadcasting FM. Man, I love it.
Let's do it, man. Well, if you need a co-host, man, I'm there with you, dude. So listen, thanks so much for sharing so much. We went through so many different things today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Jack. If you want to listen to the Q&A part of our live conversation, just look in your podcast feed. There should be part two already in there for you. But let us know what you think on Twitter. I'm @BZD and he's @JackButcher. Look forward to speaking to you then.